Welcome to a special edition of Museum Chat Live. Our community is filled with diverse stories, and we recognize that our story begins with the indigenous peoples of this land. We acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on lands that have been inhabited by indigenous peoples for millennia, and we would like to honor the centuries of indigenous peoples who walked on Turtle Island before us. Well, it's 2024, with years behind us since we wrapped up the virtual museum lecture series, we've been able to share about half of the lectures with our wider audiences. We are thrilled to bring the rest of our hit museum lecture series to the podcast so that more of you can enjoy these fascinating stories and join in on the historical adventures. Of course, you can always catch the original lecture over on our YouTube channel. If you enjoy the lectures, our podcasts, and our programs, why not consider making a donation to the museum? Your donations help us to continue to provide the high quality and enjoyable programming that you have come to expect from us. We really appreciate any donation you're able to make. Visit our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca, or give us a call at 905-984-8880 to make a donation. Your donation makes a difference. On today's episode of VMLS Via Podcast, we're sharing a lecture titled Return to Civvy Street, Post-War St. Catharines, presented by Sarah Nixon. This lecture was originally recorded on March 29th, 2022. Enjoy the lecture.
Majority of St. Catharines' Second World War veterans began returning home in September 1945. A particularly symbolic note was the arrival of the 10th St. Catharines Battery RCA at the St. Catharines train station on Saturday, September 22nd. The city had gathered here almost 6 years earlier on a bleak December day to bid farewell to the 10th Battery as they embarked for war. Now, the soldiers were returning home. With the headline, Dreams Come True for Vets, the standard coverage of the homecoming captured its emotion. As the train whistled into the station, happy soldiers stuck their heads out of the window, shouting and waving madly. The crowd on the platform waved back, and excitement rose to a dizzying pitch as the first soldiers began to step off the train, laden down with overseas kits and other evidences of the war that had taken them from their homes. They marched smartly from the station to the skirl of the pipes through a shower of confetti and ticker tape. Excited cries of recognition, and then a mad dash into familiar, loving arms, handshakes, and back clapping, and of course, tears. This was a soldier's homecoming. This was peace. In another almost full-page article on a different page, this one titled Veterans Overcome with Emotions, a standard reporter writes, unless you have been overseas from 3 to 6 years, you cannot imagine what it feels like to be home again. All the boys who returned with the 10th Battery have had different experiences, and all will have different stories to tell their friends and loved ones, but a theme was common to every man on Saturday. They were all so glad to be home and were so overcome with emotion at the well-planned and yet still spontaneous reception awaiting them that many could talk only with the greatest difficulty. Soldiers clasped their wives, then held them at arm's length while their wives then held them at arm's length while their hungry eyes took in greedily well-remembered and yet half-forgotten features. Tears stood out on their eyes and rolled down their cheeks, and nobody cared. The boys were home, and that was all that mattered. The significance of this homecoming moment is clear in the Standard's reporting, capturing the emotions and reactions shared by both veterans and their awaiting friends and family. This was a moment when dreams really did come true. The waiting was over, the fear, the deep fear and constant worry alleviated. The war had ended months ago, but now that their loved ones were home, the citizens could finally embrace peace. Historian Doug Oram writes of what home meant for both returning soldiers and those awaiting their arrival. He suggests that if you were to ask a Canadian service person or war worker what they were fighting for rather than against, most would have answered with some conviction of home. Beyond abstract concepts like democracy and freedom, soldiers were most concerned with returning to the normalcy of home, a notion that had remained their most powerful motivator. Recollections of loved ones, daily life in their communities, mundane routines, activities with friends, traditions with families, and even the ordinariness of a day at work. For those on the home front, home meant reunion, to make home whole and complete again. Oram also argues that home was so important to both those on the war front and those on the home front because this concept had experienced so much disruption and instability for the better part of 20 years. The Great War, or the First World War, had upheaved the life of Canadians in some way, all Canadians. This was followed by the devastating influenza pandemic of 1918 and 1919, a period of political and economic instability in Canada through the 1920s, and then the Great Depression of the 1930s. Ideas of home and normalcy had wavered for too long, and yet it still meant so much to the veterans returning home that sunny autumn day at the St. Catharines train station. Though St. Catharines was spared the worst impacts of the Depression era, its veterans, like across Canada, were still determined to return to a better life than what they had left, than what they had when they left. The federal government thought so too. The country's leaders made significant effort to craft and implement a revolutionary compendium of rehabilitation programs, collectively known as the Veterans Charter, designed to not only help veterans succeed in returning to civilian life, but to obtain the opportunities that would secure a prosperous life in the years and decades to come. At the time of the end of the Second World War, Canada faced the imposing, impossible task of smoothly reintegrating its 1.1 million veterans onto the bustling sidewalks of Civvy Street and redirecting the country's economy and society towards peacetime. The Canada that had emerged in the post-war period was not the same country that entered the war. Canadians were eager for hope and an optimism that they could hold on to, stable and secure employment, education opportunities, spacious accommodation equipped with amenities, access to food and an ever-increasing array of consumer goods. The Canadian government was optimistic too, hoping to continue the country's trajectory of economic growth and securing political stability. In tonight's lecture, I will consider how the federal government supports for veterans in the immediate years following the Second World War helped to enduringly shape Canadians' perceptions of opportunity and progress, and the government's role in guiding its people toward these ideals. In the post-war period, more Canadians than ever before had access to employment, housing, education, and perhaps most importantly, security. Whereas before, society lauded self-sufficiency and individual merit as the basis for opportunity, and of course, being white, a male, and from a wealthy, well-educated family would have helped too. But now, opportunity was seemingly available for everyone. I will first delve into how the wide reaches of the Veterans Charter came about before then exploring the post-war supports and benefits in more detail, using St. Catharines as my case study as I consider how they shaped Canadians' access to and perceptions of opportunity and their broader societal impacts. the details and statistics I share of the government's veteran reintegration program largely come from secondary sources. Oh my goodness. The details and statistics I share of the government's veteran reintegration programs, wow, that's a mouthful, largely come from secondary source material examining the immediate post-war period in Canada, including Tim Cook's The Fight for History, 75 Years of Forgetting, Remembering, and Remaking Canada's Second World War, Ken Cuthbertson's 1945, The Year That Made Canada, and the collection of essays in The Veterans Charter and Post-War and Post-World War II Canada. Whew. To garner the St. Catharines experience of the opportunities made available post-war, I will focus on the St. Catharines Standard newspaper, gathering articles with any hint of insight published between May 1945 through the end of the year. And as I attempt to paint a picture of the optimism held by Canadians in the immediate post-war period, I encourage you, the audience, to consider how our ideas of access to opportunity may have changed, or in some cases remained, in the years and decades that followed. The optimism and prosperity of Canada's post-war era was realized through the implementation of the Veterans Charter, as well as a series of broad social welfare legislation passed by the Liberal government under the leadership of Prime Minister William Lloyd Mackenzie King. In power since 1935, King had a reputation as more of a steady, stable leader than an inspiring one. Not that this is a bad thing. During the war years, to sustain the productivity of Canada's wartime economy, the Liberal government slowly crept towards enacting social support programs, one of the most significant being the Children's Allowance introduced in 1940. By 1943, the Liberals were also promising enhanced unemployment insurance, expanded and improved old age security benefits, workers' compensation, further family allowances, and more. With this slow and steady mentality, the King government also began to develop government programming to ensure the smooth transition to peace as early as 1944, the most significant being the reintegration of veterans into civilian society. This move towards adopting such generous social welfare supports was in response to the several political, social, and economic pressures. Before the Second World War, little public supports were available through the government. Rather, social support came from charities, service clubs, civic groups, and philanthropists with money to spare. However, attitudes towards government intervention in civilian life were changing. The government had recognized that the modest supports available to veterans of the First World War were inadequate in addressing their needs, and the fallout was a generation that felt disillusioned and distrustful of the country's leaders. The Cooperative Commonwealth Federation had also rapidly grew in popularity through the years of the Depression and war. A federal social democratic political party and the forerunner of the New Democratic Party, the CCF was a major threat to Canadian support for the Liberal government. Beyond championing for political and economic reform, like the nationalization of key industries, the CCF also strongly advocated for the establishment of a welfare state that included universal pensions, health and welfare insurance, family allowances, employment insurance, and workers' compensation. With the years of the Great Depression still vivid in Canadians' minds, public opinion polls confirmed that citizens' most pressing fear was that the country would slip back into an economic depression once the war ended and the government spending would be slashed. There was also a federal election set for June 1945. Above all else, William Lyon Mackenzie King wanted to hold on to his power. Campaigning on the slogan, "A New Social Order," Prime Minister King and the Liberal government put forth a platform arguing that further government intervention was the safest course of action to ensure the country's stable transition from a wartime state to a peacetime state. If the economy did tank after the war, at least there would be enough of a social safety net to cushion the fall. Canadians agreed with this thinking. The Liberal Party won the 1945 federal election, and William Lyon Mackenzie King held on to his title as Prime Minister of Canada. To set the foundations of the new welfare state the Liberals had promised, the federal government created three new departments: the Department of Reconstruction, the Department of National Health and Welfare, and the Department of Veterans Affairs. The series of legislation under the Veterans Charter fell under all three. Now, just to clarify, the Veterans Charter is a term coined after the fact to collectively refer to the wide-reaching legislation, statutes, and regulations that were enacted to rehabilitate veterans in civil life and to transition the country to peacetime operations while still continuing to build the economy as it had been during the war. Now, just to get a sense of its comprehensiveness, included as part of the charter were the following: the 1940 amendments to the Pensions Act to provide coverage on a round-the-clock basis for disability or death incurred during military service, regardless of cause; the 1942 Veterans Land Act, where veterans could apply for property and for grants to establish a farm; the 1944 War Services Grant Act to pay veterans in gratuities and reestablishment credits; education, training, and temporary unemployment benefits under the 1945 Veterans Rehabilitation Act; the 1946 Veterans Business and Professional Loans Act, and that's not even all of it. Some post-war veterans benefit practices didn't necessarily fall under legislation, like the policy giving hiring priority to veterans in the federal civil service. While I will explore some of these programs in more detail, by just listing the supports available, it is clear that Canada was keen to keep on a path of prosperity in the post-war years. The Veterans Charter was the first and most tangible steps towards the welfare state system that exists in Canada today. It is widely considered among historians, political scientists, and public policy analysts to be, quote, one of the most ambitious and far-reaching legislative packages ever enacted by a Canadian government, end quote. The support and benefit programs were generous and liberal, and money was no concern. After all that the government spent on the war effort, they could certainly spend on the efforts toward building a better society in peacetime. Still, to say that this was a large undertaking is an understatement. Of a country with a population of about 12 million people, 1.1 million enlisted to serve in the Second World War. Now that the war was over, 1.1 million veterans had earned the thanks and gratitude of their country. That's not to say all veterans had equal access to the benefits offered by the government. The support programs were designed primarily for men, hence the emphasis on vocational training and education and farm labor. But the Department of Veteran Affairs made a point to emphasize that servicewomen were fully eligible for benefits and opportunities available. Indigenous veterans, merchant sailors, and other groups also faced challenges in accessing the benefits and supports offered by the Veterans Charter. The return to Civvy Street was not without its bumps in the road. The program made available by the federal government could only go so far in reintegration efforts. Yes, they could aid in preparing veterans for employment and in acquiring land and housing. However, not much support was available for rebuilding personal relationships or readjusting to household roles and routines after 6 years of absence. Still, the opportunities under the Veterans Charter helped pave the way for Canada's social welfare system and switched the green light on the optimism and prosperity that characterized the post-war era across the country, including here in St. Catharines. To appreciate the optimism of Canada's post-war years, I want to take a closer look at the issues the government's veteran rehabilitation programs were addressing, how they were implemented, and the opportunities they created. Though I will explore these programs in the context of St. Catharines, I should note that the sources available to capture a snapshot of post-war St. Catharines through this lens were quite challenging to find. As I've previously stated, my focal primary source for researching this topic was the St. Catharines Standard newspaper. As Niagara's major reputable newspaper, the Standard has a long history as a local authority of the news and information pertinent to St. Catharines residents. However, despite hours poring over the museum's microfilm and reading the headlines of the Standard publications between May 1945 through to December, I was surprised to find proportionally little information on the local efforts put in place to support St. Catharines veterans in the immediate months following the war's end. So what follows is an analysis of a mix of Standard newspaper coverage, local and national statistics, and other sources as I attempt to tell a story of how the federal government's post-war support programs worked on the ground and how they contributed to Canadians' expectations of access to opportunity. So let's return then to the emotional homecoming of the St. Catharines, of the 10th St. Catharines Battery in September 1945. What happens next to get these veterans walking on Civvy Street? Well, in terms of more immediate benefits, once back on Canadian soil, veterans remained on military payroll until their official discharge papers were processed. They were also given a $100 clothing allowance to help re-enter civilian life. By June of 1945, the St. Catharines Standard was reporting that department stores across Canada were staging fashion shows designed to, quote, illustrate what can be done with $100 to build up a practical, inexpensive wardrobe, end quote. Though not stated specifically, St. Catharines department stores like Eaton's or Wallace's may have organized their own promotions, encouraging veterans to spend their clothing allowances at their locations. Under the Wartime Services Grant Act, veterans were also awarded a tax-free gratuity based on length and circumstances of their service time. This averaged to about $500 in 1945 dollars. This monetary payment, according to Prime Minister King, was, quote, both an acknowledgement and an acknowledgement of the burden borne and the sacrifice endured, and an encouragement to the men and women who have voluntarily given their services, have survived the vicissitude of this, the most terrible war in the world's history. These payments were not considered government handouts. Rather, the Department of Veteran Affairs emphasized in their publications that the supports available were well-deserved earnings and a means of empowerment and betterment for the future. The Department of Veterans Affairs also placed emphasis on socially preparing soldiers for their return to 70th Street even before embarking for home. Those soldiers believed, or according rather to historian Jeff Keshen, though soldiers believed that they had improved, becoming more responsible and self-reliant during their time in uniform, government officials were concerned that many men would be mentally unprepared to make the transition to civilian life. While waiting for demobilization, soldiers were encouraged to participate in a sort of basic training on how to be regular contributing citizens again. Wartime Information Bureau pamphlets and flyers were distributed, lectures were organized, and even a four-day course was designed to prepare veterans on what kind of changes they might find at home and in their communities. It's hard to confirm how many St. Catherine service people took part in this training ahead of returning home. At the very least, they may have been given a pamphlet or given a screening of the information video On the Road to 70th Street, produced by the National Film Board in 1945. Keshen also counts more than 1,200 citizen repatriation committees that were established in Canada between 1943 and the end of the war. These committees had the express purpose of helping ex-service people find work, housing, and how to best utilize the government service programs available. In St. Catharines, that group was the St. Catharines Soldiers Reestablishment Committee. Made up of local citizens, this committee worked with government officials at all levels to address veterans' specific needs upon returning home. Other community organizations were eager to do their part to help veterans reintegrate into society as well. Though the Department of Veteran Affairs, through the Department of Veteran Affairs, the service club Qantas International was tasked with helping veterans return to the jobs they had before the war, help them find new employment, and particularly aid disabled veterans in finding, quote, occupations where their morale and pride is maintained, end quote. Veterans Affairs leveraged the existing structures of such service clubs to connect the government with the communities they hoped to serve. In this case, training counselors to help veterans assess their skills and ambitions in relation to the government supports available and the demand of the employment market. The St. Catharines chapter of Qantas International emphasized the importance of making personal contact with returning veterans, with a speaker at one May 1945 meeting held at the Welland House stating, quote, "It is our duty to inform our boys overseas of all the benefits and plans and arrangements that are being made for them. Tell them we will be their pals in peace as we have been their co-workers in war," end quote. And that, quote, "the state and federal government and the municipalities can treat them as a class, but we as civilians must treat them as individuals, accepting them into our society, our churches, our clubs, and service organizations," end quote. Such views suggest that while folks at home were eager for the return of their soldiers, they were not oblivious to the challenges that awaited as veterans readjusted to civilian life. Acknowledging that some veterans would face more challenges than others, the Veterans Charter aimed to ensure that opportunity and the rewards of progress were available for veterans irregardless of ability. Unlike after the First World War, the federal government explicitly established rehabilitation programs for disabled veterans. In a September 1945 article, the Canadian press staff writer Douglas Howe writes that, quote, the Canadian community is beginning to accept the disabled war veteran for what he's worth, through the work of the veterans of the Department of Veterans Affairs Casualty Rehabilitation Officers, of which the government planned to have 66 working in various districts across Canada. According to the article, it was the officers' responsibility to approach likely employers on behalf of their clients and, quote, begin the job of reversing the employer's human habit of thinking of the man's disabilities rather than his abilities. The officers helped clients from beginning to end, quote, they walk the man through the various stages of medical treatment, the adjustment period, vocational guidance, and placement. Together, they decide what the man wants to do, what job he can do without being at a disadvantage, what he wants to worth and whether he needs training. While the language used in this article is problematic, the kind of approach to disability advocacy undertaken by the Department of Veterans Affairs, namely empowering disabled persons with agency and independence, resonates with today's approach to disability issues. However, though the article suggests that officers, quote, have found that most employers listen with interest and understanding, I could not verify the success of the program through statistics or other primary sources. Still, the sources available do suggest that communities were eager to address the needs of their returning veterans. The St. Catharines and District Workers Educational Association, for example, developed a class on veterans affairs to enable members of labor unions and others to attempt a special series of lectures on veterans affairs. And upon course completion, the members would form themselves into a committee on veterans affairs, which would offer services to all returning veterans. Such initiatives are evidence that the St. Catharines community largely responded positively to the supports being offered to veterans in the immediate post-war, and that they also wanted to take hold on the progressive moves moving forward. The collective mentality towards social welfare was changing at a grassroots level, not just enacted top down from the government. One of the most noteworthy societal impacts of the Veterans Charter were the ways it shaped how Canadians thought of and accessed education. Ahead of the start of the fall 1945 semester, an article in the Standard reads, quote, exchanging battle dress for books, Canadian war veterans are trooping back to universities in the hundreds this fall as they begin the job of knitting together the threads of their interrupted education, end quote. Though returning soldiers were entitled to the jobs they had when they enlisted, if they did not choose to return or did not have a job to go to, after all, it was an economic depression when many enlisted, they received priority placement on the National Employment Service. They had access to an out-of-work benefits program for 1 year, and most notably, could pursue a university education tuition-free. According to historian Tim Cook, by the late 1940s, half of the student body in Canada were veterans. This had ushered a new era of higher education in Canada. Before, university education was exclusive, reserved for Canada's wealthy upper-class families. Now, Canadians outside of the wealthy class were encouraged to want to pursue an education and a profession that could better their circumstances. Offering free university tuition to veterans increased accessibility for all Canadians with a desire for higher education, diversifying not only the student body, but the professions graduates went on to work in as well. close to 175,000 Canadian veterans returned to some sort of education or job training post-war. And of that number, 54,000 pursued higher education, including 2,300 women. Given that 50,000 of Canada's close to 1.1 million service people in uniform were women, this means that a significantly higher proportion of women compared to men enrolled in the education and job training opportunities available to veterans. These were opportunities that would not have been as readily available to women before the war. Partly due to the program's inherent bias, male and female veterans were guided to traditionally gendered spheres of work. About 85% of women chose occupations like nursing, hairdressing, and sales work, while men in vocational instruction pursued professions in plumbing, electrical, or machine operation. The emphasis post-war rehabilitation efforts placed on regendering work also heavily impacted the 1.2 million women who, to quote Tim Cook, powered the war effort on the Canadian home front. While there have always been women who've worked outside of the home, during the Second World War, women took on the patriotic duty of working the white and blue collar jobs that had originally been reserved for men. However, after the war, most women had little to show for their efforts and accomplishments. In order to keep their promises to their male employees who enlisted, employers were quick to drop their female employees to make way for those returning from service. Unless household finances demanded differently, it was expected that women would return to their domestic roles after the war. It is true that most women were likely eager to return home, only ever seeing their work during the war as temporary. This was their version of opportunity to be able to return to the domestic sphere. However, it cannot be overlooked that other women were inevitably resentful of being pushed aside so easily. Here in St. Catharines, as well as elsewhere in Canada, it is challenging to determine the opportunities and progress that women were optimistic for in the post-war. I had a difficult time finding coverage on women's immediate post-war experiences in the Standard. However, one rare article of note does shine light on this issue, titled "Post-War Women's Post-War Activities" by Nora C. Steed in the September 6, 1945 edition of the newspaper, weeks before the 10th Battery returned to St. Catharines. Steed's opinion piece meditates on how women's role in society might shift in the post-war era. She writes that, quote, the housewife's chief concern in pre-war days was the welfare of her family, the smooth running of household duties and supervising of her help, which in those days was plentiful, end quote. She goes on to write that the war had to a great extent revolutionized this mode of life. Gas rationing curtailed traveling and visiting generally. Food rationing had practically eliminated lavish entertainment without mentioning the help situation, compelling the homemaker to personally assume household tasks. The lament for lavish entertainment and for her plentiful help do suggest that the author came from a more privileged background than most of St. Catharines residents. But still, Steed writes on how the war unified women on the home front to contribute to the war effort. Quote, the time element had become a vital thing, so much to do and so little time to do it. But nevertheless, the woman rose to the emergency. Although faced with responsibilities outside the realm of their more intimate and personal world, there was a call for strength, pride, patriotism, loyalty, and they, the women, rallied nobly to answer the challenge and support of their country in a time of dire need. assisting in the alleviation of suffering, they worked in war plants and at home. Many, for the first time, experienced the pangs of discomfort, sacrifices, and the giving of themselves in order that others might survive. These lessons, through experience, have opened new vistas in a new world and have brought a matured realization of the great need for fellowship, understanding, and tolerance. Steed's piece calls to the post-war return to traditional gender roles, emphasizing the temporary nature of women's work during the war. However, Steed also suggests that such experiences during the war had opened new vistas in a new world, perhaps contemplating that women might have grown beyond the more, quote, intimate and personal world, end quote, that they had lived in before the war. The educational opportunities opening for women in the post-war period would have only further expanded the vistas of what was possible. Though the author doesn't specifically focus on the role St. Catherine's women played in the city's traditionally male spheres during the war, we know from other historical sources that during the war, St. Catherine's was a hub of war manufacturing activity, and many of the city's women would have stepped up to work in these factories. In fact, women and their families were even moving to St. Catherine's for the work available here. The number of employees in manufacturing had doubled from 5,500 in 1938-1939 to 11,100 employees in 1943. The immense influx of workers to the city further strained an already alarming housing shortage. Families took in boarders, and organizations like the YWCA roomed female workers. But these were all temporary band-aid fixes. The housing shortage in St. Catharines was a crisis felt across Canada, and housing was another top priority issue that the federal government aimed to address as they set out implementing their new social welfare state. By the time of the war's end, Canada's housing shortage was dire. Little new housing was built during the 10 years of the economic depression preceding the war, and due to labor shortages and the rationing of materials, few permanent housing projects were pursued during the war years. In the immediate post-war period, the federal government estimated an urgent need for 320,000 new homes to be built. And that did not account for the homes that had come under severe disrepair due to the same labor and material shortages. A Canadian housing survey that was published in the St. Catherine Standard in June 1945 reported on the condition of existing homes in the country, and its findings were grim, especially in regards to overcrowding. An estimated 12% of urban homes, like in St. Catharines, were overcrowded to the point that some members of the household slept in living rooms, dining room, and even in kitchens. Furthermore, modern amenities like bathtubs and electricity were increasingly more available in theory due to advancements in technology and infrastructure. However, not all homes had access. Such living conditions may have been overlooked during the war, but they would not be tolerated by Canadians post-war. Opportunity and progress demanded that Canadians would live in homes, quote, where they could raise healthy, happy families in comfort, end quote. The Standard was already reporting, oh, and I just lost my space in my script. Here we are. The Standard was already reporting on a serious housing accommodation shortage in St. Catharines for returned soldiers and families of soldiers overseas, end quote, even before VE Day was declared in May 1945. While the 1944 National Housing Act had the explicit aim of promoting the construction of new homes and the repair and modernization of existing homes across Canada, the projects were not yet moving fast enough due to ongoing labor and material shortages. The homes that were being built were under the Wartime Housing Limited, a crown corporation with the express purpose to build vast housing in Canada's industrial centers to provide adequate living conditions for industrial war workers. Established in 1941, wartime housing's first priority was to reduce the industrial bottleneck that deterred factory workers from certain manufacturing centers due to lack of housing in the area. These homes were designed as temporary accommodations, constructed of non-essential materials and prefabricated sections so that crews could erect the building in as few as 36 hours. Whole neighborhoods of 200, 500, and even 1,000 homes in some cities were constructed across Canada through the wartime housing program during the war years. Fast forward to 1945, now the supposedly temporary homes built by wartime housing were a quick solution to finding accommodation for returning veterans. By the end of the Second World War, 550 wartime housing homes had been built in St. Catharines. These neighborhoods were built on the outskirts of the city, in close proximity to major war manufacturing facilities. These include 133 homes built to serve the McKinnon Industries munition plant, and the 109 homes built at the eastern end of Welland Avenue, close to the QEW, as well as several production factories. Of an interesting note, the streets in these neighborhoods were often named after wartime associations. Dieppe, Cardiff, Dunkirk, Plymouth, Coventry, and Lancaster, to name a few. Although wartime housing was built for war workers, due to the housing shortage, if one became vacant, it might quickly be snatched up by tenants not in the industry. Noting the rapid labor turnover in the munitions industry, in 1945, just before war ended, the St. Catharines City Council put forward the recommendation that, quote, if soldiers' families could be given priority on all housing, on all wartime houses as they became vacant, end quote. This action would at least ensure that some housing would be readily available as more veterans began to return home. In a May 1945 article published in the Standard, St. Catharines Mayor W.J. MacDonald called on the federal government's Minister of Munition, Minister of Finance, and Minister of Veterans Affairs to assist St. Catharines in securing additional wartime housing explicitly to house returning veterans. In response, the federal government ordered Wartime Housing Limited to build a new survey of homes in St. Catharines specifically for veterans. This resulted in the construction of another 85 wartime homes. In total, 634 wartime housing units were constructed in St. Catharines. By 1948, over 380 of these homes were occupied by veterans and their families. And this was not unique to St. Catharines. By 1946, a new federal crown corporation, the Central Mortgage and Housing Corporation, was established to secure permanent housing for returning veterans, as well as to administer the National Housing Act. As a successor of Wartime Housing Limited, the CMHC repurposed the thousands of wartime homes already built across Canada to address veterans' urgent needs for housing. These temporary homes became a part of a permanent solution. And many of these homes still stand today, some 80 years after construction. Through the National Housing Act, the federal government was also committed to building a lot of new housing. After victory in Europe was declared on May 8, 1945, the government announced a goal to build 50,000 new homes within 1 year of VE Day. Despite the shortage in building materials and skilled tradespeople that still persisted, this goal was surpassed within 7 months by the end of 1945. Another 67,200 homes were constructed in 1946, and 79,300 in 1947. Whole new suburbs popped up across the country, a tangible symbol of Canada's new wealth and consumer buying power. Again, new perceptions of opportunity and progress drove Canadians' particular frenzy to find single-family dwellings. And through the government's veteran rehabilitation programs, this opportunity was available to more Canadians than ever before. Under the charter, the CMHC offered offered veteran mortgages at 5% interest and a 25-year term. Monthly payments on an average $4,000 home cost about $22. And with the opportunity for home ownership now increasingly accessible, by 1947, veterans had collectively purchased some $200 million worth of housing. The success of this post-war initiative cannot be understated. By enabling veterans to buy their own homes with money provided by low-cost government-backed mortgages, the government had infused a massive amount of money into the economy, catapulting the country into the most prosperous era in its history. This didn't just benefit veterans. This opened opportunity and progress to all Canadians. They now had more buying power than ever before. According to Doug Ulram, Canadians' post-war consumption patterns and mass exodus to the suburbs reflected a collective desire for security and stability. Would the opportunity and progress being offered by the federal government last? Canadians were drawn to security. The last 15 years had been anything but secure and stable. But now, through the social welfare program set up by the federal government, Canadians were enjoying higher employment rates and were amassing more wealth. Opportunity and progress were here. With the purchasing power available to them, Canadians could buy their way to comfort and security, not just in the homes they got a mortgage for, but also in the consumer technology now available to them to ease their home life. The new homes built through the National Housing Act were equipped with central heating, hot and cold water, flush toilets, and baths and showers. Consumers could now also more affordably purchase electrical appliances like electrical ovens and mechanical refrigeration. The consumer technology and material goods Canadians began to purchase to fill their homes were a palpable, tangible form of opportunity and progress in the post-war world. Security and stability were available, accessible, and affordable. The housing developments administered by the National Housing Act paved the way, quite literally, to the rise of suburbia in Canada. Low-density subdivisions with single detached lots became the norm, the epitome of post-war middle-class opportunity. Veterans wanted to raise their families in quiet neighborhoods with grass, trees, and flower gardens and a picture window to admire the view. The demand for space required housing developments to expand outward from suburban centers, sprawling in all directions. In St. Catharines, suburban development expanded south towards the base of the escarpment as New Glenridge extended from Old Glenridge, and Lockhart Road became the city's new southern boundary. The city's suburban sprawl also crept north towards Lake Ontario, on the other side of the QEW, as well as east, with the development of Secord Woods east of Hartzell Road. You can see on the maps I have on the screen here, this first map shows the general evolution of urban and suburban growth between 1936, which is colored in black, and the dotted line areas showing 1946. Not much growth, as I've been talking about, the Depression, the war stagnated this. But we see from 1946, all of the black that's filled in, plus the expansion of the suburbs south towards towards what we now know as the Penn Center in that area. No matter where these suburban neighborhoods sprouted, in St. Catharines or anywhere across Canada, the homes of the suburbanite would have varied little. Modern convenience became one of the biggest indicators of opportunity and progress for the post-war family. Under the National Housing Act, new homes were built with enough space on the property for a driveway, making room for the family automobile that households were increasingly able to purchase. By 1950, Canadians owned 2 million cars, access to which gave Canadians more opportunity to live further away from work and to spend money more conveniently. However, while convenient, cars were also a necessity in suburbia. The new residential neighborhoods erected in the post-war years were built in isolation from commercial areas. New zoning bylaws often forbid businesses from opening in residential sections. Without the corner store and public transit options relegated to main streets, and pedestrians discouraged by distance, families were now expected to drive their vehicle, their own vehicle, to obtain necessities. Shopping malls and shopping strips set back from the road with lots of room for parking became one-stop shop solutions for the suburban family. In St. Catharines, City Council approved the construction of the city's first large shopping center in 1957. First named the Niagara Peninsula Center, this shopping hub was originally built as an outdoor plaza. The Penn Center was eventually renamed and enclosed. Fairview Mall opened just north of the QEW a few years later in 1961, amidst much of the city's major post-war housing expansions. Fairview Mall was actually one of the first enclosed malls in Canada. One by one, the supermarkets, department stores, and movie theaters located in downtown St. Catharines moved into the Penn Center and Fairview Mall. Convenience then also came at an expense. The rapid cultural changes of the post-war period was not kind to family-run businesses of downtown areas, and the natural green space raised for suburban neighborhoods could also not be reversed. In addressing the post-war housing shortage, the work of the National Housing Act also shaped the country's approach to population growth, continuing to meet housing needs with unrestrained sprawl for decades. The consequences of such are felt in today's current housing crisis. As the country entered the post-war era, the Canadian government took a risk and enacted what government officials called, quote, the most ambitious program of rehabilitation ever undertaken in this or any other country, end quote. The risks paid off. The benefits and support programs offered to the Second World War veterans helped to stimulate a golden era of economic prosperity in Canada. More Canadians than ever before had access to educational opportunities, employment and opportunities, housing opportunities, and increased consumer buying power. The programs developed under the Veterans Charter and other post-war legislation set the foundations of Canada's social welfare state, forming a deep connection between the government and the opportunities of progress available to Canadians. From the post-war years onwards, Canadians' perception of security and stability would be tied to government intervention, for better or for worse. Canadians were eager to welcome a new era of optimism, and the Canadian government was determined that its future would be different from its past.
Hi, it's Adrian again. We really hope you enjoyed the lecture. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us via our social media channels or museum@stcatharines.ca. Don't forget to subscribe to our social media channels, blog, and podcasts so you don't miss out on any of the historical fun. More information is available on our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca. Next time on VMLS via podcast, the Indigenous Underground Railroad. Thanks for listening. The Virtual Museum Lecture Series is presented by the St. Catharines Museum and Welland Canal Centre.